So that means it's working. So welcome everyone, and thank you for coming. My name is Alana Hickey. I'm a graduate assistant for the Poetry and Poetics Colloquium and one of the fellows in the newly formed graduate cluster. And I can't say how pleased I am to introduce you to Saigo this afternoon. Saigo's work is perhaps most comfortably at home within the New American tradition, representing a thoughtful integration of Black Mountain, New York School, and San Francisco Renaissance influences. And his most recent collection, Stranger in Town, cites these traditions warmly in figures like John Wieners and Charles Olson. But Saigo's work moves beyond these and other influences he encountered during his time at Naropa Institute or in his frequent collaborations with visual artists. Influence is never totalizing here, but becomes a conversation, careful not to overwhelm each poem's unique perspective. Saigo's growing collection of work showcases poems that can confidently stand alone in their pure lyrical playfulness, but these are also poems that reward careful, responsive reading. Poems that open themselves up again and again to those willing to thread the connective tissues between, for instance, bits of street graffiti and a Creedence Clearwater Revival lyric. Such cognitive leaps come much easier than expected under the light touch of Saigo's rhythmic guidance. As the title poem reads, "There's a bad moon on the rise, and I've got quite a stash, rubbings from the Calligram graves. I've explained their hollows in brick, a crossword is written in script, young blood straight edge." The potential for discovery and an unceasing, unexpected musicality thrills the reader to the end of each line. But as Saigo thematizes found form, he also uncovers the construction of poetic form as a process of his own. Saigo invites the reader into the solitary world of poetic method in pieces like The Sun and The Emerald Tablet, where he writes, "Each poem was once a separate jewel. They have since been washed into very broad fabric. I have let it roll out and paid the highest price for what many assume to be found pieces. It doesn't feel as if anyone is working over anything to get a desired effect." To someone who studies the 19th century, this feels almost Poe-like. And stay with me for just a second. So, you know, in that moment in the philosophy of composition when Poe starts to go line by line through The Raven, to tell us exactly how the poem achieves its desired effect. But with Saigo, the explanatory gesture, which in Poe feels like a glimpse into something inaccessible and a realization that I will never read The Raven the way it was meant to be read, and then the resulting distance between the moment of composition and the experience of reading, with Saigo, somehow the gesture becomes about intimacy. His work relentlessly opens up to the reader and makes method transparent in a way that somehow reinforces and enlivens our channels of comprehension. We never do sense someone working over something to get a desired effect, but we suddenly feel part of the process. Even here, in a piece that might read as an undemanding essay on construction, we feel the invisible yet considerately thought-out workings of poetic precision, what Saigo fittingly terms that, quote, hand-sanded lens. At moments, reading and writing become the same process in these poems. Both promise the same glimmer of escape within painstakingly constructed arrangement, relying on a careful balance between set lines and calculated turns and an illimitable fluidity of feeling. This balance, the necessary tension between containment and escape, is everywhere in his poetry. And I think Saigo says it best as plaintive skin and boiling insides. Take, for example, in my last one, Morning Train, a poem that begins, like much of Saigo's work, with the explosive possibility of an empty room. It reads, quote, "I have a room for three nights. It pays me no mind. My lines are columns pulled up and straight sinking. I begin to see burned in every verse, an alcove, a rest, a bloody lumbering foot. I have cracked the words filled in wine, the song that skirts the ones rehearsing, part of the old divine threat, exquisite, trailing strains." What begins as terse, straightforward description and sharp lines on a page that mirror those pulled up columns of a cold hotel room falls gradually into bloody lumbering foot that charms with its irregularity. These are indeed words filled with wine, and Saigo cracks their calculated structure without shattering the form that enables the delivery. Here and elsewhere in Stranger in Town, Saigo demonstrates that unique possibility for familiarity amidst even self-proclaimed strangers within the confines of a poem. I emphasize the generous collaborative sensibility of Saigo's work because he has agreed to share that sensibility with us once again, this time not within the peculiar confidence accessible only through the solitary reading experience, but face-to-face in a workshop that I suspect will continue to illuminate the otherwise imperceptible craft and construction. And we're all very grateful for this opportunity. Please welcome me, please join me in welcoming Cedar Saigo. I did so well.
Thank you very much. Yeah, an introduction like that makes this very easy for me. And I think Alana asked me when we first started writing about doing this and talking on the telephone, just to ask me, you know, what are you doing now? And that's a question that I find it's very helpful to ask, to be asked that question or to ask yourself. And it's been about 2 years since Stranger in Town came out. And sort of the subtitle of this talk would be something like The Haunting of Stranger in Town and how it's kind of informed my work since it's come out. And now I find myself about 40 pages into my new book, or about halfway done. And I find now I get into the process of writing pretty seamlessly. It's usually like I hear an initial line or a strain of music, or you know, half of a line even, and those often work as triggers. And usually the stray lines from the past few weeks, they fit onto those first lines. And I feel like the way that I take language in, once that trigger happens, it's sort of trapped. And it feels like a virus. I think it was William Burroughs who first spoke of it in that fashion, as sort of a condition that you're forced to live with. And I remember the poet Clark Coolidge. I saw him read once, and he started off by saying, or in the beginning of one of his poems, he said that he attempted to stop writing poetry. And he said he was successful for about a year. And then one morning he started hearing this endless flow of language again. And he said, and I thought, oh no, it's happening again. And I can now, that I'm a little older, at the time I just thought, you know, oh, that's charming. But I realized that's real, you know, it's a condition. And for me, it's an attempt to isolate a lot of these inflections that I hear, or making links between nouns. That's all in the service of like what I think of as bolstering the language. And as the content starts to build and the body of the poem begins to appear, then I start, you know, adding wings in places and like clipping them in others. And then I think, looking back on it, I'm thinking like, is this a form of balance that I'm after? And one of my friends wrote a line in a poem, and it said, "How beautifully do the brakemen allow the blood through?" So I always think about that. It seems a lot of times like it's just this block of text, and you have to find this path through that's completely dependent on rhythm a lot of the time. And it's taken me years to accept, you know, this process that I'm attempting to describe. It took me years to accept that as the process. It was, you know, even though the same thing would happen over and over, I would sort of worry that it wasn't going to come again, you know, but now I've recognized, like, maybe it's not ideal, but this is the process, you know. And I wanted to read a poem by Ted Berrigan that kind of, it describes what I'm saying, but in poetry, which I think is helpful. And especially the first stanza, but I'll read the whole poem because I like it. And this is from a book called Red Wagon, which was actually published out here in Chicago by the Yellow Press in 1976. It's called Soviet Souvenir. What strikes the eye hurts. What one hears is a lie. The river is flowing again between its banks. Grant one more summer, O you gods, that once I did not ask. The windows through which the bells toll are like doors. Because she is direct in her actions and in her feelings. Under the puns of the troop, there are frescoes on the rudder, which you set against a bracelet's fire, and which goes toward you with each beat. I find myself there. Am I finally ill at ease with my own principle? Fortune be praised. Immense density, not divinely, bathes us. I hear walking in my legs. The savage eyes into wood look for the head they can live in. It's my window, even now, around me, full of darkness, dumb, so great. My heart willingly again beginning, crying out, and at the same time, anxious, loved to contain. But I love that beginning because that's exactly what it is, that helplessness to begin writing. What strikes the eye hurts, what one hears is a lie. You know, things that stand out to you that are inescapable. The river is flowing again between its banks, which is kind of what I'm talking about when I say when you begin editing and you take things out or you add things and all that, you lose track of time. Grant one more summer, O you gods, that once I did not ask. And then the best line ever. The windows through which the bells toll are like doors. I love that. So the music is happening, and it just becomes, you enter this whole world, you know, through the act of composition. And I don't know, lately I, like since this book has come out, I like to start a lot of the times with like an exercise or a prompt or something to like lower the bar. I think a lot of times poetry, especially by non-poets, it's considered this thing that's very ancient or wise or heavy. You know, it's a very old form. So I like to kind of, I don't want to be bogged down by content or intention a lot of the time. So I like to start off with an exercise and whatever that becomes, I'm open to. But I think, you know, if you use an exercise or a concept to begin writing, it can become this sort of form-fitting entrance. The work can almost feel, in that case, like it's been executed in advance. Like all you need to find is the right entrance. And like the work is already available in some like pseudo-secret antechamber. A recent kind of example of this is a poem I wrote called The Old Music, and probably like 2 weeks ago, so pretty recent. But I restricted myself to just using lines from this book, which was different than doing a cut-up or, you know, cutting up like Rimbaud or the newspaper or the usual thing, or Shakespeare or whatever people would use, or all three of those things. It's different if you cut up your own work that you have a relationship to, like your own manuscript, because I'm pretty familiar. I mean, this book's short, it's like 80 pages, and I've read, you know, it's 2 years old, so I've read it from it fairly often. So I'm kind of familiar with the hooks of it, the ways I could choose lines from any of these poems that seem the most characteristic of the poem's overall appeal, you know, the essential lines. It's sort of like, I was thinking it's like slipping old gemstones like into a new setting, and it's and then content-wise, you're totally unattached, really. It's sort of like a perfect blank composed of the not too distant past. And I've tried to read it a couple times, and it's kind of emotional to read it because it's like 5 years of your life condensed into this kind of new assemblage or collage. It's completely emblematic of, you know, those 5 years. And I think that, I mean, the way the assignment would be, or the way it would be useful to you, would be to take an old manuscript, you know, whether or not it's been published or anything like that seems irrelevant, but to take your own work and do that. It's because what I think what you'll get out of it is more like undoubtedly you'll recognize the places in which your work functions purely as music. And what are the configurations, you know, that you rely on rhythmically? I think that's something that, you know, only time will sort of tell that. But doing exercises like that, you start to realize the way the ear goes. And I had a teacher, Ann Waldman, actually, and she used to have this great phrase. She would say, cannibalize the text, which I loved. And so I wanted to read that poem after so much talking about it. The old music. Walking through clear water in a pool painted black, I just slip in and out, shadows, planks, moonlight through quizzing glass, untaxed accents. The dark is a cool stone, spark in life, never cloying. I am in pursuit of absolute fluency. The torn strings of words get hanged, make the surface of a mirror, rat you out and change your life. I've been uptight all this week, wishing invisibility. I have a room for 3 nights. It pays me no mind. It's more about what the room wants. I trace my surface, rose and silk, music for torching, and the present possibility of danger. The tree has grown between the window and its bars, a hardened form of the mind turned fluid. The parts one had always wanted a listener for, glowing with the rush of blood, he rose. He had an air. Forest flowers balanced and steamboat rocks, garden of the gods. Go back and visit, rulers of the interior. I cross green and white flowered seas, this nosebleed all spring, all wet, and willingly shining me on. This is my test of the ink, the privacy in composition prized, connecting passages to the black vaults, and clear purple tomb in a doorknob. I took out a writing room also. I appreciate its stable and its manner, its drowned exile, flight from what restless longing, arrows longing for the other bank. So are there any questions about that or ideas about that? Has anybody ever cut up their own work or?
Well, I have a question. I mean, I'm not a poet, so I haven't heard of any of my work. But I always think of my own writing, because I've written some scholarly books, as a process of endless rewriting. And I will, mm-hmm. I always tell like students, graduate students when they're working, you know, write something and then go in and tear it apart. Don't become too attached or, you know, to any sort of precious formulations. And when I'm working, I sort of do something and then I'll go back and I'll look at a paragraph and I'll realize everything that followed was wrong, so that has to go, and it goes in this direction, but some of it may come back someplace else. So when you were talking about the kind of composition of the old music, I was really, it sounded to me like the kind of process of creation, you know, that it really mirrors what you're doing as a writer, and isn't so distinctively different from what I think of what I'm doing when I'm writing something, and I wondered what the difference was between that kind of process of eliminating, throwing away, rewriting, moving, you know, taking things that you've already drafted and, you know, and then the later process once the work has been published and you go back in and you start extracting and taking things in different directions. I mean, how that, you know, is that sort of categorically different than...
It's very emotional. I mean, this time it seemed like I could read it and it wasn't as emotional, but the first time I read it was just to a friend in my living room, and I felt by the end that I was like choking on my own blood. It was so emotional. But I feel that way too. When I finish anything, even blogging or prose, even like the comments for this class, I like to write and then I like to like put it away, you know, And then I come back and I see, you know, things that, stuff I could never see. It's almost like you make something and it needs to like dry,
right.
You know, and then you come back and the paint needs to dry before you add the next thing or you get rid of something. And I think that's, the process for prose is like, it's different, you know. I feel like now I can study something and take notes and then that becomes prose, that becomes the essay writing, as long as I do the actual work and find the right sources and take the notes, then. And poetry, it's, like I said, I mean, a lot of what I'm saying is like, you know, it's, I don't decide exactly, you know, I make a space for it. It's very much of a courtship, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk about one other poem that I wrote recently, which was called Language Arts. And it was written for this poet, Dana Ward, and he read this book. So again, this book is just coming back to haunt me. He wrote a sonnet sequence after reading this book. And so I wrote a poem for him, and it was composed entirely, I have an iPhone, and I kept using the notes section when I was out and about, just hearing things at a bar or, you know, taking the subway, or just good lines that I thought of myself or ideas for writing. And I just would put them into my iPhone, and they were usually, when I combed through them, some of them were sort of dull and lifeless, sober, they were horrible. others were like levitating, absolutely pure lines, stuff that I felt like they did not deserve to be diminished or even contextualized in any way. And placing all these outcast lines in one place was sort of this alchemical golden form. You just put all of the things that don't belong in one place, and you know, that becomes a form. But I just kept adding. It helped that I didn't comb through these notes. I had been collecting them for like 2 years before I decided to do this. And there were like 129 separate notes that I just sort of mined through. And I only took the best. I really didn't, the stuff that shot out to me, that's what I used. And after reading through it a million times during the heat of composition, that's usually what I do. I just end up reading it aloud a lot. I saw that what I was wondering, like, why am I writing this, and why is it for Dana? And what I realized was it was like a rendering of what I guessed Dana had enjoyed in this book, and then also sort of the difference between us. And it seemed to concern maintaining like a healthy circulation between the words, but in my case, letting the language lead as opposed to placing the reader within a narrative and sort of guiding them through. And so I'll read that one now too. It's a little bit longer. Language Arts for Dana Ward. Moose jaw times, Herald Mets, yellow bits. In a sprung for Yolanda game, you know I am boss. In the shade of the running board, sun, eagle, owl, diamond dove feathers, take me down. Please stop this. I'm headed your way. This is the happiest unrelated night of my life. Look on the notes. See you pinning it on me. World of pain, games 2 and 3, exceed in value as fits. There are so many poems to go around tonight. There is not one game in town. A bishop that ate the vessels, hid the words to gain his finish. A dust died up the sides, who fell into its rot, rekindled in words. Did you see how deep mine dug? Since when does she sing? She wrote her book of pool hall memoirs for money, as did Franz Kafka, Chester Himes, Valerie Larbeau. Spackle, you fuck. Build my fort and score the edges of my lozenge. Sized everlasting, mineral makeup. Gray on camel tone. Grayish? I, too, know what I am not. Watching electricity return to a town across the river. Learned germs, fields of excised herrick, shaving faded flu lads. I still possessed a swiftness of spirit, Chinese bound in covers of hammered card. brittle Jewess, sour earthworm eggs, morning in Keyport, a wall, a jet of ink, after dark we wake again, picking clean stones from the beds of our teeth, etching with a ghost, dark red, brown, blue, black umbrella. I love strangers in an ailing mansion. That's how they've groomed the stars of today, as escorts. I saw so many people I used to know. I like my nice Portland white friends. They live to be super young, pretty sloshed professionals of the language. Leave our machines running in plain view, in space surveillance variations. Yeah. So yeah, that's a weird one. So I thought to myself, with that poem, like, am I pulling the words together or like tearing them apart now, you know? But I think my whole process of writing is dependent on variety. You know, I do have poems where I place the reader in a narrative and sort of guide them through. I don't want to just do one type of poetry. And that's why I am also grateful to get blogging jobs or to do art criticism. Or, you know, it was nice to do blogging and to be asked to do that kind of writing because I learned to write in complete sentences. You know? I felt like a real writer as opposed to this romantic poet, you know, who could only deal in like, precious fragments. So, are there any other questions, or?
I have a question. I was just thinking about the sort of pedagogical valence of language arts.
Yeah.
You make these references to the importance of exercises to start a new compositional process, and you referred to that quotation by Anne Waldman. I'm just curious what role you see school or the poetry workshop as having played in your formation or continuing to play?
Yeah, when I did a long, a couple workshops at Naropa, I haven't since then. I did one with Anne Waldman on the long poem, I remember. And I think I was a little notorious for being like really hard on people's work. But I can honestly say that I was just as hard on myself, you know, and you know, I hear people complain about workshops a lot that in fact, you know, people just want to be patted on the back, you know, or something like that, or that seems to be a cliche, but I think, you know, you should really, if you see the same, what I remember, you know, is that you would see the same mistakes over and over. You know, or what you considered, you know, a weakness in someone's writing the next week. It was as if you hadn't said anything the week before. And that always drove me a little crazy. But I think that, I mean, I think the way you can make the most of it is by being very honest, you know, and being, you know, spending time with the work, you know, and directing people to books and things that they might not know about. And I think experiments, I know Bernadette Mayer, who's one of my favorite poets, she had a kind of a famous workshop at St. Mark's Church. And out of it, they made like a list of experiments and a list of exercises that people still use. It was published in a book called In the American Tree, which was like a early language poetry anthology. But I think things like that and working together, collaborating, crossing, you know, collaboration is not just everyone adding to a poem. Collaboration is more editing together. That's a much more delicate exercise than, you know, adding a line or two to something. Can you be honest and say, oh, let's add this, or why don't we move this here, and then read it aloud together again? You know, it's, I think that a workshop can be good if you lose ego, almost. You know, but a lot of time, what I experienced was people want protection in a workshop, but the dismantling of that is where you really get to your personal standard, which is all you really have. Because then you go to a poetry reading and it's like horrible, you know what I mean? But your writing and your process, you know, is completely divorced from that. You have no idea what other people are doing, you know? You only have this like personal standard. which is what I'm trying to convey by describing this thing, which is, you know, very personal.
Well, I mean, I have several questions, but one question I'm just sort of curious to ask you about is, I guess maybe the sort of the flip side of John's question, which is just, I mean, your poems are full of imagined addressees to other poets from several generations. I found it compelling to hear you thinking about, when you were writing Language Arts, about sort of straining to hear in your own work what one of your friends found compelling or something, right? And that there was this sort of struggle to describe the form of pleasure that you deliver into a community of others. Made me think about, like, you know, people like Robert Greeley always talking about company, or and you know, academics throw around words like coterie and community and so on and so forth. But I guess I'm curious to hear how you imagine your relationship to, say, things like, I don't know, that sort of personist view of the poem as a directly delivered unto a company of other poets, and how you imagine that poetic community right now.
I've never been one to, like, make my presence known in San Francisco by running to every reading. You know, I've seen that. Some people do that, and I do go to some readings, but I have just a few poets that I keep in mind, you know, as sort of my imagined company, or the people, or there's some great, I wish I had the poem Robert Creeley where he imagines all the poets that he really respects sitting at a table with him, you know, and I have that, but it's probably like a table for like six, you know. It's not as like, but, you know, poetry, it's dependent on, you know, readings in living rooms, or, you know, a reading that starts off as a party and then becomes a reading and then becomes a party again. I think, you know, and weird alternative spaces, and then those can be very, very. I think that's the life of poetry, really, and small magazines, stapled things, you know, fugitive publications, but. Yeah, I guess I am kind of a, I think, you know, in San Francisco, I mean, with the poets, everyone lives in Oakland now anyway, no one can afford to live in San Francisco. So I'm sort of, I'm physically removed from the community, but I, I'm kind of, I keep to myself, I would say, a little bit. But that doesn't mean that I don't, like, I do, you know, these things, or I'll do things as they pertain to writing, but the social aspect of it sometimes, I find that's way more difficult for me than writing, or talking even about writing. I like to do that. So should I read more, or?
I have a question.
Please.
This goes back to old music.
Uh-huh.
So from this point of view, I can, like, see the text that you're reading.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
So I noticed that it's sort of like in a large block. And I think when I read some of your poems from Stranger in Town, I was struck by visually how they appear on the page.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could talk about that, like, when you're composing a poem, right, you give so much care to the lines.
Yeah.
And sort of how you arrange it on the page and how that makes it feel different for you. Or
yes. What I realized about a lot of times I will... take the sort of, I'll steal, like, layouts from poets that I admire a lot. Mm-hmm. Frank O'Hara is one. I definitely have stolen sort of floor plans from Frank O'Hara. And Larry Eigner, this poet who has this beautiful sort of leaning diagonal kind of thing in his layout. But I realized that, I break the line definitely. It seems like scored for the page and for the voice, and then the space between the lines that dictates, like, how long that pause lasts. So I do it really to help myself to know where the voice naturally wants to pause or pick up again. So it's very literal, even though it looks very fancy, you know. And then I've also had friends help me, because I will have an idea of what I want to do. And then one guy, this guy Micah Ballard, who's also a poet, and I would send it to him and be like, can you help me exaggerate what's already here, please? Mm-hmm. You know, because I want it to be even, he can just kind of manhandle it. Mm-hmm. And so that's just occasional, but yeah, it's very intentional. And in fact, I mean, I don't even think I have the old music right. It's really fat. But really, I think there should be like a line running down the center, and they should be about half. The line should probably be about half what they are. But it's only 2 weeks old, so yeah, it's still being fucked with.
Yeah. I think that's sort of beautiful to hear, that like the negative space is an intentional pause, right? Because it, for me, makes the reading experience, I don't know, it...
Yeah, it does, I mean, it's great. Sort of, I mean, yeah, and I think, and you have those poets that you think of, you know, that read really well, you know, and they could make anything sound great, you know. And it's through, I think, paying attention to the poem on the page and obsessing about it, you know, knowing that it's not, that this is not quite right, you know, and that really, that's, you know, that's important. Like the smallest thing that nobody else would even care about, you know, or not even another poet wouldn't even recognize that it's a mistake. You know, it's just a completely, you know, if I left a line out of something, you know, or if I took a line out, would people really even care, like in the audience? But I know, you know, and it will keep me up at night.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had a question about those moments of discovery in your poems, when you find that there's suddenly a reference or something that feels familiar, and I wonder if you, when you include those in your work, do you make those decisions with the experience of reading in mind, right? Like knowing that someone might stumble upon a reference and understand it,
uh-huh.
Or is that
am I
self-driven
aware?
Thing.
Yeah, no. A lot of it is. You mean like the what you wrote, like the Creedence Clearwater
yeah.
and those things.
But I find yeah. that there. Well, reading your work, I can feel there's a reference, and I don't know it yet.
Yeah.
A lot of times,
yeah.
And I have to work for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's an intentional move.
A lot of my stuff, it doesn't feel. Intentional, you know, and then I definitely like lose track of time when I'm doing it, and it's almost like when I'm done with the fit of writing, it's almost like coming up for air or something, or so I don't, it's not, I would say it's not contrived.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's mostly that I find that that's what fits
yeah.
at that moment, but of course the references would be, you know, stuff that I love, or obviously I've taken it in. So, but it's nothing that I plan in advance, or I think, you know, such and such is so great, and there's not much intention to
yeah.
it, really.
There's
it's all part of the music.
There's so many writers now that are dealing in such programmatic ways with modes of citation.
Yes,
and,
projects, yeah,
and
everywhere.
I mean, it's just systematizing.
Yeah.
Rewriting, copying,
yeah,
citing, where usually it's not allowed to, like, this that kind of citation is not allowed to sort of just sort of comfortably sort of flow along on the eddies of memory.
Yeah.
Do you feel that your work is in dialogue with poets that are dealing in more programmatic ways with citation? Is there an oblique kind of response to that?
Well, definitely people have asked me about it a lot, you know,
mm-hmm. yeah.
over the years, because I do think that that must be a quality mm-hmm. of the poetry, that that it has these references. And but I don't, you know, the way that I don't feel like it's connected is, you know, I'm not I don't look at the map, you know, I don't have a bird's eye view of it before I begin, and a lot of that stuff with citation and a lot of like projects and things like that, they're, you know, they're dependent on like an intellect and being clever and things like that, you know. I can think, I think, you know, and they, you know, they're interesting, but yeah, it's more of a whirlwind, you know, than a book like that would probably require, you know, more of a mess.
Should we move to the, if you
yeah,
want to
sure,
read some
I'll
poems?
Read
unless
some
someone, unless there's another question.
Yeah. I'll read all the B-sides that I am not going to read at the Poetry Foundation, so. And I'll read a couple of those things. And and this is untitled and pretty new. And I am the man that every sound in this room will come from, a lovely new control panel. I am still finding my way. There is no protection, though one would be that at any cost for one's loves. Those harbor lights I've kept in line and still sidestep. Sparks off the halo reach a far wall. The desk is piled just right, mostly dream. I have scored a few extra fields, too, with typed poems. Sitting perfectly straight, no need to fuck and turn in early after my smoke and simple hanging of the robe. I have been made messier, more myself, disgusting. Maids, car and driver, trust, new ways for enforcing a long thread. Curtains flung, choir slanted, drones on the wind. My sensitivity creates technique. The suite left open in slender gate, key doors shining forth. A level in concentration few can make it through, and Ed has it, and Jackson. Write it all down, hide it, before I hate the exhaust. The next day, builders fit it all in to hear the actual words aloud. This is called Taken Care Of. I come from Inuit oil money, from instruments of chance and divination, the most loose, shut-in, wavering mind, recording my day with recitations, antennae, narration and figure. My phone might die. I'm walking dirty. Shop and mob cops not to touch my mother's breast or the Queen's royal crown signature. Izzy Juju, hijacked, forsaking all others. The untamed scotch is mine. It cost the picture a fortune, to say nothing of my turban. Costume copies of topaz bracelets, the upteenth translation. Did you ever know Micah, Gay Sunshine, Grace Cathedral, Coconut? I went from heels at Barney's to the depths of the bins. Who could be like dropping in? I'll fold both my hands in gloves and wait, Hope Diamond peeking out. Ambrosia. What did I miss while in Paris? The big game. Rod Roland wrote that before I did. I wish to be more like him. Crystal gazing lights are in perfect darkness. What can I make with what I have? Happy anger, a plywood press primer. I gotta keep going soon. Capsized off Crete like tomorrow. I would knock seeking sanctuary in the city of Poseidon. I grow older, type the faintest lights and the sleepers awake, key doors shining forth, the guard so thin and fleet and wending its way, through what channel, damn fast, splintered glass, bottom boat, blood brought to ghosts. This is called The Underwater Box Escape for Micah Ballard. And this was written after I read my friend Micah. He had a book in this same series, and I read it, and I wrote this kind of in response. After dark, let hot blood run over my basket. Remind me to ask him back. The edges of the flatware plated, more than beveled, gilded. the first spring of light, long as a lance lingers, whose pointed end tips the first floor, heart of the target, left of the lens, talking with himself between stations on foot, the call to battle but a whisper, a ribbon loose up and over the hill. Moondog turns back the children's crusade, his Citizen Kane Jr. blues instill bravery and blood weddings, webs, spirits drawn as upright flames tied to a masthead. They work in reverse off the waves, picking up where I slack off in Macau and Bolinas, my face most drawn at the shadow's end, corners of my mouth bathed in black, bouncing back. This one it's called Panels for the Walls, and it was kind of inspired by like ancient Chinese poetry, which I love. It's so dramatic. Panels for the Walls. Leave the long fall between us, peak after peak. Here were my paints, and there were my powders. And then I was drunk, and we lost each other. My shadow tumbled after, soaking cinnamon leaves in the lake of the moon. The roll of the damned drum calls me to duty, the dice in the light of the lamp. I hear a stone gong. I lean full weight on my slender staff. Yellow leaves shaken and petals confused to my garden. The hard road is written to music. How lovely locks in bright mirrors in high chambers. The moon shows further a gold and silver terrace. The northern grass is blue as jade, a dream, venting in the pit of heaven. This is called Paris. I can disappear before your eyes, killing you. I slay you with my eyes, you disappear. That's how I would remember that line, and how to write, actually, certainly, stupidly. Only the ladies strumming language. They are not women, they are knights, wrestling these lines off the back of a knife. They have a second life spent in stone, and so attended. Bomb the bridge to heat my hands, work their handlers in order, go to the movies all day. Only to collapse and focus, to finally hand off my faded flower. Caring and pointed, she brought me up and loosened my mind toward the checks and imbalances and cameos in Lucifer's Grotto. I remember a full-on Scottish plaid suit, the Gravitron sexodrome growing out of Apollinaire's grave. Empty balcony seats, operatic little fills, the poems of a multi-billionaire, a vow of silence, fine and mellow, all the things you are. And this one is called Things to Do in Suquamish. And I'm Suquamish native. It's a reservation in Washington, pretty remote, across from Seattle. And I taught a workshop in Seattle, and one of the exercises I had them do was a Things to Do poem. Ted Berrigan has the Things to Do in New York, Things to Do on Speed. This is a poem I wrote in my own workshop, which I was very proud of, that fact. Things to Do in Suquamish. Smoke salmon, call San Francisco, like totally. Get driven to the terminal, escape. Come back after dark and feed the horses. Alfalfa, Timothy, oats, pick their hooves. Visit the Suquamish Museum. The eyes of Chief Seattle are shut, his spirit to himself. Sepia tones, baskets, white hot rocks, cobalt trade beads. Say hi to all my cousins, cul-de-sac. Hi Josh, hi Jeremy. Drink Rainier beer, a red ribbon out, up, and over the peak. I confuse it with Mount Fuji. Walk back to Dad's room. He talks when he wants and smokes. linger over his bookshelf. Moby Dick, Starling Street, all of Kurt Vonnegut. Try and write the serial killer light at night. See through green and black. Give up. Try prose. Yeah. The things to do, it's such a good form. Like, you know, I think that anybody can write a really endearing poem with that form. I don't know. Maybe a couple more?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. That's good. Oh, this is a good one. This is called Jokes. It is a means of taking inventory. Good night, nurse, the sun. The book is comprised of several smaller stapled books. I am 33. It's more like I know what works. You don't lose your way of hearing language. Jokes to pair off like a gift and curse. Lately, I think of poking out the changes, unfamiliar with my tools. Ideas are priceless. It seems less a matter of execution. Scored these complete sentences instantaneously. Other advice, be as hard on yourself, harder in fact. Occasional pieces, poems for birthdays, drawings, lowering the bar, which is really me tricking myself, letting new color and weights flood the arrangement. It's still a bit of a forbidden city, a matter of courtship, a classic American carnival in the middle of New York Chinatown. It has all been through invitation. Seattle, Portland, Philadelphia, Boston, and New York twice. The content of this book come to life. So many hot groupies. I've just got to write another book for all the wrong reasons. By any means necessary, take me away from my life. All right, I'll read one more. And this one, I thanked a bunch of people at the beginning of Stranger in Town, and then I just used this list of people as a key for this poem, and I just kind of addressed each person, but it kind of ends up seeming like one person. Yeah, so. It's called Ode. Master collagist, lover, householder, editor, surrealist confidant, making magic pointed underpinnings on paper pulled through a typewriter. Personal priest, follower, hold up in Cairo, stuffy small room you never want to leave. Ballad heirs, the only young woman I would love to be forced to make love to. BFF tennis stars together. He would bury his paintings. I think that had to be it. He was a better queer than most live ones, too. Lonesome traveler who would try everything and get mixed up after. He made private music. I spent more time with him than anyone. A psychic who saw words or heard them or found small filthy objects on the street that came back as words. He loved poems more than graphite he used to make his works. A father and furious maker of a million books. Poetry books made for birthdays, one copy, reading to his countess daughter. Hot punk ass, huge cock and personality, big mouth performance, amazing. The writer everyone co-opted sooner or later. It's the new Pello book, don't miss it. Tree trimmer, painter of small square pastels, a Marlboro man, Canadian coveralls, short fiction. Printer of expensive magic and the poems from the new Winter Palace. String of small machines, shy guy, editor, spawn of dyke and fag, a real bully in Colorado Springs, father of one. I think people thought we were together at least once. Sad poems tracing the beautiful decline of Santa Cruz or any Chinatown, seriously. He found love and stopped publishing so much. The best accidental poet and beauty consultant and dealer, believer, pissed off Muslim, or that was the rumor. I would just drop in on him. He turned me on to Fielding Dawson, John Altoon, and Charles Olson all over again. Phoenicians, long talks on their very possible establishments, heretofore unrealized, cock tees, very able writer and critic, portrait of Dorian Gray Steves, impeccable evening, Hermes. Answering the desk phone every 5 seconds, very generous. He gave me $20 when I swept into town as a fake hustler. a thousand years, genius prose. In several bands and none to match his genius. He is not playing dumb, he's quiet, pimp of the year, and maybe my favorite. Could you play me my last rites? Torn paper film of a wolf man's romance, and in the end he rises from the grave, or does his maiden. Joke night, opera plaza, taking tickets. You're so good to me. You printed my secret ceremony next to a poem by the one I love. You bring half-drunk bottles to parties. Believer, curator. He said he was going to paint a house. He left me in bed where I watched loads. I think that he was hustling, that's what she said. His shows were tight and massive. He could appreciate a turn of phrase or lyric, threading the needle. I don't want to live without your love. Thank you.
So it's one, but so those of you that have to leave can, I suppose, but Cedar has agreed to stay and chat. So thank you for coming, everyone.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Cedar.
Thank you, it was fun.